please the court. There's 3 points of error in the brief, but I think I'm going to spend majority of my time talking about points of error number two and number three. Point of error two relates to the conviction in count two of the indictment for the violation of 18 U.S.C. 924C, possession of a firearm and furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. We believe, before we get started on that, I think the dates are important to kind of lay out quickly and then talk about where the evidence was insufficient to establish that. First of all, the main act that Mr. Shaw was engaged in of delivering the ecstasy occurred in April 8th of 2004. The testimony at trial from a co-defendant, Mr. Posey, said that those relations with Mr. Shaw ended at approximately the end of 2004, beginning of 2005. And Mr. Posey's role was acquiring the ecstasy and marijuana and bringing it up to the Sherman area. But his relations with Mr. Shaw ended at that time. Also, I think that was important is that Mr. Posey and then the other two defendants, Derek Nelson and Sterling Blanton, were then arrested in 2006. The original indictment came down in August of 2006, and then Mr. Shaw is arrested January 11, 2007, and that's where the firearm was located, in the apartment at his girlfriend's house in 2007, some 2.5 years or almost 3 years after the initial delivery of the ecstasy, the 20 tabs of ecstasy. And I think that's important because in order to establish that he possessed a firearm in furtherance of the crime, it had to be in relation to count one. In count one, he was charged with conspiracy to distribute ecstasy and marijuana. And that's important because the way that the association was between those men, it's my view that that association ended in 2004 and 2005, and so therefore the conspiracy had ended.
What's the proof? We know that Posey, as I understand it, Posey at trial said, well, I stopped in whatever he stopped prior to when that firearm was found because I didn't want to sell crack anymore. The risk was too great, the term of imprisonment or whatever. But what is the proof that the other two or three stopped being engaged in the conspiracy other than that they were arrested? And what is the proof that no others were involved in a conspiracy with Shaw?
Well, I think the evidence at trial showed that once they were arrested, you had two agents from DEA as well as local law enforcement that testified that they investigated this group for 2 or 3 years, and there was no evidence presented from any of those government witnesses that said there was an ongoing conspiracy at a later time. They had any evidence to suggest that they were continuing to engage in this conduct, and the fact that they were arrested ended their role in the conspiracy. And so,
But are you saying ipso facto arrest means end of role in conspiracy, or is there any proof about the end of a role in a conspiracy?
Well, there's not any proof to say have either one of them that came in and said we were done, the conspiracy ended at that time, definitive proof, but the fact that they've been arrested and no longer out on the street and in custody, they can't participate and further the conspiracy.
But they could, even while in prison. We know that. I don't know that you can take judicial notice of it, but I mean, just because you're in prison doesn't mean you don't communicate with the outside world and try to engage in criminal activity.
Right, but there's no evidence presented by the government, and I think it's the government's burden to prove that the conspiracy's ongoing, because then if it's on it's our responsibility to show that the conspiracy ended, then that shifts the burden of proof to us. And I think the government didn't provide any additional evidence to show that there was any continuing interaction between these gentlemen up until the time Mr. Shaw was arrested. And so part of that, it's an interesting question, is how do you affirmatively show I'm not part of a conspiracy anymore? Do you go to local law enforcement and say I'm done, you know, engaging in criminal activity, so I'm not part of the conspiracy? How do you affirmatively do that? And also, while thinking about it, also, if Mr. Shaw had to prove that he was not part of the conspiracy through an affirmative act, would that not
be? Well, certainly the burden is on the government, but just to say, well, the proof of no conspiracy is arrest. I'm not sure that would satisfy your burden, especially the very strict standard of review we have for sufficiency of the evidence.
But also I would say that when they returned the indictment in August of 2006, that showed that the conspiracy, you know, because they pled that it started in 2003 and up until the time of filing in the indictment. So when the indictments returned in August of 2006, I think it could be argued that then at that point their interaction ended and the conspiracies ended at that time.
Does the indictment name Shaw and then sort of other named people and unknown conspirators, as many indictments typically do, such that even assuming that Shaw and the named persons are arrested, there are these other unknown defendants that I think we have some cases that speak to when unknown conspirators or names in indictment that might or might not demonstrate any into the conspiracy. Do we have that in this case?
Right. It was pled that you had Mr. Posey, Mr. Blant, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Shaw, and others known and unknown to the grand jury. So there was pled as unknown co-conspirators.
Was that in the superseding indictment or that in the original indictment?
It was in both. They pled it in the original indictment, and then when they superseded, they put the unknown.
What is the date of the superseding indictment?
The superseding indictment was returned. It was in February of 2007. I don't know the exact date, but it was in
about a month after the firearm was seized.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in the superseding indictment, they alleged additional narcotics, which was the cocaine and the cocaine base that were found in the apartment, of his girlfriend's apartment. And I think that the issue as it related to the cocaine and cocaine base is important, too, because at trial, in response to a Rule 29 motion, Judge Schell granted the Rule 29 motion as it related to the cocaine and cocaine base, saying you haven't proven that there was a conspiracy as it related to those narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the only way that they are able to bootstrap the firearm count back to the original indictment is the 78 grams of marijuana in the freezer. And so looking at Judge Schell's analysis, as he worked through that at trial, you know, he's like, you haven't proven to me that there's other conspirators that relates to those drugs. And I think the same analysis is as it relates to the 78 grams, because at that point, all they could prove is whether there was an unknown conspirator. But they didn't prove any additional evidence to show that there was an unknown conspirator.
Did Shaw present a defense?
No, we rested after the state's arrested, Your Honor.
And the conspiracy conviction, which you, in your brief, you don't challenge the underlying conspiracy conviction. You simply challenge the drug quantities found by the jury. What effect did those drug quantities have on the sentence?
Well, they significantly impacted his sentence because then he was held responsible for that such a large quantity of drugs. I think in my calculations it went from a potential sentencing range of just the 20 tabs of ecstasy of 24 to 36 months to then he was up to the 130 months with his criminal history and that large quantity of ecstasy and marijuana.
All right.
I would also say with regards to in the 924C count two is that they also had to establish that the 78 grams was a distributable quantity. Because there was evidence in the apartment, assuming he possessed it, and that's my next issue, is whether or not that's personal use or was that he was engaging in distributing 78 grams of marijuana. And there wasn't any evidence.
They found, the typical scales for weighing. They found some plastic baggies or something generally used for distribution, et cetera, et cetera. And once again, you're bumping up on a very difficult standard of review.
I know I'm sliding, heading uphill on this, but I think also, I think as far as the record was, there was a scale, but I don't think there was any baggies that were consistent with distribution. There was simply the packaging that the marijuana was found in, which was in a tinfoil package in the freezer, but there wasn't any indication or signs that there was an ongoing drug distribution going out of this apartment that belonged to his girlfriend.
Was there any testimony about why marijuana would be in tinfoil in a freezer? I have no earthly idea what effect that would have.
Well, I think, and I'm not sure whether I asked Agent Ruth this, but, I think I did, was that putting it in the freezer, it's commonly known that people put their marijuana in the freezer because it keeps it fresh and it doesn't dry out and it doesn't get stale, so there's a basis for. It's not uncommon to see marijuana in a freezer or in a refrigerator.
This was the government's expert that testified about typical indicia of drug distribution?
The way Agent Ruth testified is basically he's never seen a quantity of drugs that wasn't distributable. I mean, that was basically in his 19 years of experience. He couldn't think of any other reason why you would have 78 grams of marijuana other than to distribute it. And that was my big dispute with his testimony because he wouldn't concede at all, and I think one of the questions I asked him, I said, you wouldn't even concede that this would be personal use, and his response was, no, I wouldn't. And so he simply has viewed it that it's 78 grams. It's in a, the way it's packaged, it's distributable. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. There's no other reason to have it that way. And I don't think that, his opinion that in every case it's distributable is a valid, accurate opinion based on that amount of marijuana, which is not a significant amount.
Why was he testifying? Was he tendered as an expert, or was he simply one of the agents?
No, he was tendered as an expert to then, on the basis of showing why firearms are near drugs and why people would possess firearms.
And you are not, and of course that's not one of your issues on appeal, you're not challenging his expert testimony.
No,
other than a sufficiency of the evidence basis.
I'm familiar with, Officer, Agent Roof's, history and worked with him in many cases. So he is, he's done lots of cases, but I think in this particular case, I think when you look at the facts of where the weapon was found, that it's not his apartment, that it's his girlfriend's apartment. They haven't established that he had care, custody, control of that apartment. To then say he, one, possessed the firearm, and then, two, that he possessed, even assuming he possessed it, that it was in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. I think the thing that's interesting in this particular case is, there's not any baggies or signs of distribution, there's no money found in this apartment. There's no money found on Mr. Shaw. There's no money found on Ms. Langham. And also, Agent Ruth, when he's looking at the marijuana, there's signs of marijuana usage in the apartment. On the coffee table, there's use that people had smoked marijuana. Well, that's consistent with someone's personal use of marijuana, not a distributable quantity. And so the government, in a way, is trying to say, well, yeah, there's signs of personal use, but therefore he possessed the marijuana, but they don't want to use that same factor to then say, well, it's not a distributable quantity.
Did the prosecution take any fingerprints off of the gun?
No, they did not make any efforts to process the weapon to see who had handled it or if there was any usable prints off the firearm. So I think when you look at it...
You're saying they didn't attempt to get fingerprints at all, or they did try and didn't...
No, they did not attempt at all to try to establish whether or not there was any prints. And I think the other thing, too, in this case was... There were supposedly pictures taken of all this, of locations of things and where they were found and what was discovered. And, of course, those pictures were lost or deleted in some way, shape, or form. And so we didn't have the benefit of being
able
to...
Was that made known to the jury?
Yes, it was.
And you argued that to the jury?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And I think the other thing, too, that was important was that the agent from the Marshal Service who was assigned to do the investigation of this arrest never wrote a report, never documented any of these things. It was all related to Agent Ferry, who then created a report or sometime later created a report. And so there's never any document that we could rely on to say whether or not these things, what time they happened, when they happened, and where they happened. And I think that was critical as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Let me finish, get to point three real quick about the mistrial issue. I think the statements by U.S. Marshal Abel were extremely prejudicial to the case because obviously one of the main things we were arguing about was possession of this firearm. Since it was found in an apartment not belonging to us, there's no connection to the firearm other than our mere presence in the apartment. His statement to the jury that he was deemed armed and dangerous was extremely prejudicial. Obviously we asked for a curative instruction, but that was the main issue in the case, was whether or not he possessed a firearm. And then once he makes this statement that he, in the past, has been known to carry firearms, which there was really no basis or evidence that I had seen prior to that was the case, that was extremely prejudicial to us. And as well as his statement that he would flee from law enforcement implies that he does have a prior criminal history, prior record, and therefore it's character evidence that then I think once the bell was rung on that, it's hard to unring that and say, well, don't consider that statement anymore, that he may have possessed a firearm in the past, because then the argument is, the inference is if he possessed in the past, he possessed it this time.
So you want a new trial on all counts?
Yes, Your Honor, because I think those statements significantly impacted the way they were going to view the evidence as well as, Mr. Posey's testimony and the entirety of the testimony, and I think that's important. And then finally, since I do have some time to talk about point of error number one on drug quantities, obviously, a person can be convicted on the testimony of a co-conspirator, but I think under this particular circumstance, with Mr. Posey's background and prior convictions, I think the evidence was insufficient on that point. Thank you, Your Honor.